Again, we find ourselves together, and I'm very excited to be with you today, as always, and to be doing this next set of meditations on Book 3 of the Yoga Sutra. You know, one of the questions that came up that someone asked this week is, what's the difference between samyama and meditation? And the answer that the Yoga Sutra would give you, that Patanjali would give you to this question, is that samyama is a post, in its pure form, is a post-samadhi state. It's like you find yourself in samadhi. Excuse me, I'm moving my mic around. Samyama is a post-samadhi state, and the true samyama, the samyama that Patanjali is talking about, is very advanced practice, because in order to do it, you have to have been able to completely enter into the pure absorption on whatever it is you're meditating on. And then in that absorption, in that samadhi state, you would decide to contemplate a particular center or a particular issue, bringing the full power of your samadhi to it. So what we're doing is actually meditation. We're doing dharana on these sutras. And what I have been finding as I do these practices is that because they are so psychoactive, you know, they really, really have a quality of transforming the mind and awareness as you do it, it's not really necessary to have entered a samadhi state before doing these practices, because the practice itself will start to open you up in ways that are not necessarily described in the sutras, but which many of the commentators get. And it's one of the reasons why when we study a text like this, a sutra text, we actually need to approach it contemplatively. We need to approach it through practice, not only through explanation, but through practice. And we need the explanations. So in time, as you practice, and your ability to enter very deep meditative states increases. You know, I know there are many people in this class who do that, who can do that. It's my wish for all of you that you find yourself in a place and in a state and with the capacity, the intention, the time to give yourself very deeply into meditation, to allow the process of samyama to arise out of your absorption. But in the meantime, even if you're simply approaching these samyama sutras as dharanas, as modes of concentration, and I think most of you have experienced this, they're going to give you a lot. They're going to transform your consciousness a lot. So let's begin our practice of focusing lovingly in the lake, beginning to really tune in to our community here. And you can find yourself a comfortable posture. Your eyes are closed. You open your awareness, your consciousness, to include, to encompass all of us, recognizing that we're all here together and that our shared spaciousness, the space that we're experiencing together, is actually enhancing every part of our practice. So your practice is helping everybody else's practice. Everybody else's practice is helping your practice. So you're there by the lake within the beauty of the great lake of consciousness, Lake Manasarovar, imagining yourself in the Himalayas, surrounded by tall, majestic mountain peaks covered with snow. And yet here in the space around the lake, it's warm, it's pleasant. And as you look into the lake, you recognize why it is called the Lake of Consciousness, because it is itself psychoactive. It is flowing awareness into you. And as you inhale and exhale, feel that you're inhaling the beauty and the awareness that flows off the lake. You're holding in your hand a candle inside a jeweled holder. And as you look into the flame of the candle, offer into it your intention for our time together. Now offer your practice for the benefit of all beings. We ask that through our practice this evening, all beings experience happiness and the causes of happiness. All beings participate in this opportunity to become free of suffering and the causes of suffering. That we and all beings experience the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. That we be filled with equanimity, transcending passion, aversion, and dullness, being able to observe the fluctuations of the mind and senses with equanimity, and that we recognize the equality of all that lives. And feel that your candle is now placed on the waters of the lake. and just take a moment to be aware of all of our candles. Our candles filled with our intentions, filled with the power of our practice, floating in the Great Lake of Consciousness. We've offered our intentions, we've offered our wishes for the well-being of all, and we ask that we be transported into the states that Patanjali is revealing to us. And we'll chant the opening mantras, the invocation to Shiva, the eternal Guru, and the invocation to the Guru Patanjali. First, beginning with three long Oms. You can bring your hands to Anjali Mudra. Shivaya Gurave Satchit Ananda Murtaye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase. Salutations to the Eternal Teacher who exists within us as pure being, pure awareness, pure joy, who is peaceful, luminous, without form, who is never not supporting us. And we salute Patanjali. Vande Gurunam Charanaravinde Sandarshita Swatma Sukhavabode Nishreyase Jangalikayamane Samsara hala hala moha shantye abahu purushakaram shankha chakra siddharinam sahasra shira samshvetam pranamami patanjalim pranamami patanjalim pranamami patanjalim. Firm your posture, feeling very deeply the connection between your sit bones and the seat. Allowing yourself to sit a little bit forward on your sit bones, which helps free the lower back. Feel the torso rising upward through the crown. Feel the presence of all of us and bring your awareness up to the center of your forehead. We're going to do a vertical sweeping breath. Starting in the center of the forehead. Inhale into the center of the forehead, and then exhaling, allow the breath and your attention to descend from the center of the forehead down the middle of the body into the perineum. And then with the inhalation, allow the breath to rise up from the perineum through the center of the body all the way up to the crown. exhaling now, descend, let your mind and breath descend from the crown, perhaps feeling that it sweeps through the forehead, through the area behind the nostrils, through the throat, through the center of the chest, through the bottom of the sternum, through the navel center, the pelvis, and down to the perineum. Just let yourself exhale and be aware for a moment of these centers, and then as you inhale upwards, simply allow the breath to sweep upward, not paying so much attention to those centers, but knowing that having tuned into them, they're now alive to the flow of the breath. So as the mind follows the ascending and descending breaths, don't feel like you have to visualize these parts of the body. See if you can let your attention feel the very subtle movement of the energetic dimension of your breath, the prana, as the inhalation flows upward from the perineum to the crown, and the exhalation flows downward from the crown to the perineum. As you follow the breath, see if you can tune into the highly refined aspect of the breath, the energetic aspect of the breath, the prana shakti, which as it flows upward with the inhalation and downward with the exhalation, is actually filling your inner body with its radiance, harmonizing, nourishing the organs and systems. If there are thoughts arising, if there are distractions arising, very, very gently merge your mind in the flow of the breath. And if the breath feels jerky, it's okay. As you focus there, it gradually begins to smooth. And even as you open your eyes and pay attention to what I'm going to be saying, See if you can keep some part of your awareness with the breath, sweeping up with the inhalation, down with the exhalation. And I also want to point out that this particular type of movement is not what we normally do. You know, as you know, I normally teach the inhalation flowing downward and the exhalation flowing upward, which is the tantric approach to the vertical breathing. We're doing the practice the way it's done in the yoga tradition, in which characteristically the inhalation is a rising breath, the exhalation is a downward flowing breath. And I'll explain this at some point, why it is that tantra and yoga find the breath differently. They actually even give different, they have different understandings of what prana and apana are, so, which is why the breaths are done differently. But they're both powerful. Some of us have a tendency to prefer one way of breathing to another, and it's always good to experiment. So during these classes, we have been very much emphasizing practice, using these Samyama Sutras as transformative meditation prompts, really, which they are. And we're going to continue with that this week, but we're also going to get a bit more metaphysical, and some of the practices that we'll be doing are somewhat more analytical than what we've been doing earlier. This class is, to some extent, about how the Yoga Sutra defines liberation, and especially about our relationship between the buddhi, the innate intelligence, and the purusha, the inner self, the atman. So if you think back to book one and to our first classes in our first course last April, which many of you attended, you'll remember the famous definition of Patanjali Yoga, and even if you didn't attend those classes, you probably remember it because it is one of the most famous sutras in all of Eastern literature. You know, it says, yoga citta vritti nirodha. Yoga is defined as the stilling, the sensation of the movements, the vrittis of the mind, so that, this is Sutra 2, so that, as Sutra 3 says, the seer, the purusha, can rest in itself. Otherwise, and this is actually what the whole text is about, otherwise the seer identifies with the instruments of experience and with the ideas and sensations that these instruments, the senses, the inner senses, the tanmatras, the manas, the seeking mind, the ahamkara, the dread ego, and everything that arises in the body and in the mind. Normally, Purusha, the Atman, identifies with all the ideas and sensations that are reflected back to it from buddhi, from our innate intelligence. And liberation in Patanjali Yoga comes when we're able to detach the Atman, the self, the Purusha. I'm going to call it pretty much the Atman in this class. It's not the word Patanjali uses, but it's what Purusha is, the inner self. Liberation comes when we're able to detach the Atman from its instruments of experience, that is, from the buddhi, the ahamkara, the manas, and the body, and then rest completely within it, even when you're engaging in the world. It's the ultimate form of inner attention. So remember, in Patanjali, the individual consciousness, Purusha, the soul, or the Atman, is purely a witness. It doesn't act, but it does illuminate all experience. And, you know, there's a lot of beautiful poetic statements throughout classical Indian spiritual literature, starting with the Upanishads, which describe the Atman, it shining, everything else appears to shine, is really the great statement here. You know, like the sun, which illuminates everything and also itself, the Atman illuminates the mind, the senses, and also illuminates itself. So the Atman is self-illuminating, which means that it's completely independent of everything else. So, and it's One of the great analogies that I really love that actually meant a lot to me when I was in my early days of trying to understand what the Atman really is, I read in a Zen piece of Zen literature that the Atman is like the light that illuminates a room but is no way affected by any of the activities in the room. So, you know, in daylight we see everything because of the light, but unless we are actually seeing the sun, we aren't aware of the source of the light. And in the same way, pure consciousness, the Atman, illumines everything and witnesses everything without actually intervening in it, and also without normally being seen. But, you know, again, this is a review, of course, but any activity that we experience that is experienced in reality is done by Prakriti, the matrix of the natural world, which consists of the famous trio of subtle powers called the gunas, which are constantly moving, mixing with each other like primary colors. You know, the way the primary colors, red, blue, and yellow, mix with each other and come up with every possible hue in the color spectrum. This is it's the mixture of the gunas that create the limitless psychological and physical dispositions of all living creatures and all physical forms. So it's really important in understanding the way this world is structured to get that everything in this subtle and physical world is made of different combinations of the gunas. But with one or another predominating, and it's the predominant guna that makes for the felt sense of what this, the element or the psychological state and everything in between is made of. So air, for instance, is mostly sattvic because it's transparent, it's light, it's buoyant, but it contains other gunas in smaller proportions. The sun is mostly rajasic, you know, it blazes, it's hot. A rock is mostly tamasic, though all of these elements include other gunas, I almost said gurus. So the universe, starting with the inner universe, is churned, as it were, is brought into motion by the endless, ceaseless movement of the gunas. We talked about this last week, but I'm returning to it again because in order to do these analytic meditations, it's important to be aware of the metaphysical teaching of this text, which is carried through the whole of Indian spirituality, and it also appears in the tantras. You know, even though in tantric understanding there are many realms of experience that are beyond what Patanjali calls the Purusha or the self, but up to that, the understanding of how reality is structured is exactly the same. So buddhi, which is pure intelligence, is the first product to emerge from the churning of the gunas. And the nature of buddhi is intrinsically sattvic. It's pure. It's clear. And because it is so sattvic, for a normal person, buddhi is, you know, the experience of buddhi is basically the experience of our higher self. You know, it has the functions of judgment, discernment, knowledge, willpower. It contains the will to virtuous thoughts and actions. It's aware, and it contains our highest cognitive capacities. In fact, you know, if you want to tune into buddhi right now, as we will be doing, you know, throughout the first part of this class, you might just turn your attention back on itself and see if you can find your cognitive capacity. You know, we could call it the knower, the knowingness. Can you touch into that essential quality of your inner consciousness, which is its capacity to know, to, you know, not even think, but to know, to perceive, to be aware, to be awake. So this is buddhi. It's always awake. It is intelligence itself. So in many spiritual systems, you know, we talk about the higher self and the lower self being that part of us which is so identified with the body and the thoughts and the experiences that we're fielding from what we believe is the outside world, that we're in a state of confusion. Our samskaras run rampant. You know, we are capable of believing in all sorts of weird, illusory ideas. We're incredibly reactive. That's the experience of the lower self, which I know none of you ever experience. That was meant to be a joke. But always, you know, along with our reactive part, there is the observer, the buddhi, the one who actually can discriminate and discern. And we'll say more about that in a moment. So in its purest state, buddhi is clear, it's peaceful, it's happy, it's aware, and it's discerning. And it's also not only the subtlest part of our personal self, it's also the interface between our personal self, our empirical self, and the world. It's the interface between us as individuated beings and pure consciousness, Purusha, the Atman. So it's the primary screen, instrument through which the Atman experiences reality. And what that means is that the state of buddhi actually determines how the Atman, how the self, is able to appear and experience the world. When the buddhi is outward facing, when it's focused outward on, you know, on the inner instruments, the body, the mind, the senses, it actually shows Purusha the world. It reveals the world to Purusha. And so when it's inward facing, which the buddhi has the capacity to do, it has the capacity to turn inward, which is essentially what we do when we practice meditation and self-inquiry. Buddhi has the capacity, when it turns inward and clarifies itself, to reflect the Atman, to reflect pure consciousness, which is pretty much the secret of how sadhana works, right up until the moment when you completely immerse yourself in pure consciousness and merge into it. We're pretty much always clarifying the buddhi so that instead of reflecting the various forms of confusion that the other inner instruments often give us, it can reflect the purity and beauty and clarity of the Atman. And the problem is, of course, as we know, the outward-facing buddhi is affected, we might almost say afflicted, by all the samskaric distortions which we've been looking at and contemplating throughout this course. You know, buddhi gets affected by the other two gunas, rajas, with its endless activity, its passionate engagement, desires, anger, all of that, you know, intense emotionality, and by tamas, which dulls the buddhi and diminishes intelligence, actually makes it very hard to, you know, to discern and discriminate. Buddhi also gets affected by the states of the ahamkara, which is in its normal state totally identified with the body and the personality and all the condition, every single mood and state that you experience. And it's also colored by the endless movements of manas, the sense mind, which keeps bringing in information through the senses, literally filling up the chitta, the mind field, including the buddhi, so that, you know, right now I'm in my office and I'm looking out. I can see my computer. I can see the window with the, you know, twilight is coming, and I can see the trees and the hills outside my window. And truly speaking, my mind, my attention has taken the form of what it is that I'm experiencing, including you guys and including this talk that we're having, this lecture that I'm giving. This is the nature of the outgoing buddhi. It gets completely colored and filled by our experience of the so-called world, both the inner world and the outer world. And remember, all these, you know, the subtle instruments of our inner world, which give us the power to experience reality, they all emerge out of buddhi. They come out of buddhi. So she is, in a certain sense, the source of it all. And this is why in dreams, for instance, we can live an entire life without being identified with a particular dream body. You know, we have a dream buddhi, which makes choices and decisions. We have a dream manas, which identifies all the sights and sounds of the dream world. We have a dream ego, which identifies as the I in the dream. And we have subtle senses that weave this inner world that, you know, becomes the dream world. You know, and as you know, in Vedanta and in Buddhism, the metaphor of the dream is one of the major metaphors that are, you know, that is meant to help us understand that the world, the reality we are experiencing in our normal state, is not actually the way things really are. And in other words, Vedanta and Buddhism fully believe and teach that what we experience in physical reality is just a more permanent version of our dream state. The thing is that, you know, a dream can be beautiful and a dream can be nightmarish. And when the buddhi and the other instruments of perception are so distorted, we experience the intense suffering that is so much a part of life in the physical plane. And mainly, the Purusha can't see itself. It can't be reflected because the buddhi is too clogged. So Purusha is unseen, and what that means is that it can't reveal to us the joy, the happiness, the wisdom, the power that we actually have inside us. This is what the Yoga Sutra means when it talks about worldly experience. It's talking about that endless churning which carries us from experience to experience. You know, in Tantra, the physical world is considered to be a part of the field of sacred Shakti. So the physical world is seen as a pathway to the highest states. In yoga, in the yoga philosophy, the physical world has a bad reputation precisely because if you're not aware of what it really is, it's filled you with suffering, which is really the result of buddhi and ahamkara being filled with karmic samskaras and tossed around by the two gunas, rajas and tamas. And in Sutra 35, Patanjali flags this point, which is really core to the metaphysics of yoga philosophy, and he proposes a samyama practice for moving through it. And here's what it says. I'm going to read this Sanskrit. Sattva purushayor adyanta shankir nayo pratyaya visheso bhogaha paratatvat suarta samyamat purusha jnanam. Worldly experience, this is the translation. This is Edwin Bryant's translation. Worldly experience consists of the notion that there is no distinction between the Purusha, the self, and pure intelligence, the buddhi, although these two are completely distinct. Worldly experience, so he's repeating the point that he makes in Sutra 4. But by now we've had a lot of explanation of what this means, so it has a kind of a deeper impact. Worldly experience exists for another, that is, for Purusha. In other words, worldly experience is meant both to entertain the Atman and also to show it why it needs to emerge and reveal the truth about itself. And we'll say more about that in a moment. But the self, Purusha, the Atman, has no other purpose than to be. It doesn't have to do anything. In fact, it doesn't do anything. It doesn't have to prove anything. It simply is. And in that isness, it's ecstatic. So the Samyama says, by Samyama, on that which exists for itself alone, comes knowledge of Purusha. So one way of understanding this, by Samyama on that which exists for itself alone, comes knowledge of Purusha. What this text is asking us to do is to meditate on the felt experience of the absolute independent Atman, which has no entanglement with anything. I sometimes talk about an experience that I had in my early days of sadhana. Actually, I was meditating with my teacher, with my guru, and I consider this experience a complete transmission of grace from him. And in that moment, the room, the people in it, the building, the sky, my own body disappeared into this open spaciousness. And I realized that there was only that in the world, and that consciousness, which contained all this, was me, was my consciousness. And the primary experience was of being absolutely alone, nothing else but consciousness. And because I was unprepared for the experience, it wasn't unreservedly pleasant. You know, sometimes when we have one of those really intense awakening experiences before we're quite prepared, it's scary. But it completely changed my life and my experience of what is true. And yet it was so big, you know, so kind of ultimate. It was, I think, a glimpse of the state of liberation that Patanjali talks about, except that it also contained my fear. So I wouldn't say I was self-realized as a result of it. But I did become aware of the truth of the texts. So knowledge of the self in yogic terms is not intellectual understanding, which most of us have. It's direct experience in the moment. You know, not direct experience that you had 30 years ago, like my experience of Kaivalya and that meditation retreat. It's direct experience right now of the absolute independence of the Atman, the recognition that comes in deep meditation when the entire world dissolves into the Atman. It's ecstatic beyond anything in the ordinary world. So this sutra is pretty straightforward. It gives you a direct process for liberating the Purusha from being colored by or identifying with anything else. It, you know, and it was also my guru's teaching. He used to, his core teaching was meditate on your inner self, on the Atman. Honor yourself. Worship yourself. Because God lives within you as you. So that was his teaching. He used to say it all the time. He said it so much that it became a cliche for his students, and we didn't even think about it. It was just like, oh, okay, meditate on the self. But for me, especially in the early days of my practice with him, I was constantly asking this question, so how do you meditate on the self? You know, I mean, how do you do samyama on Purusha, on the Atman, when you haven't actually had an experience of the difference between the true self and the innate intelligence, you know, between the Atman and the Buddhi? You know, of course, again, as we've said earlier, samyama in Patanjali is a post-samadhi state. So the sutra presumes that you've had such an immersion in Purusha as you know it before you try to do samyama on it. But in the earlier stages of sadhana, when we either haven't had such an experience or we don't trust our experience, which I have to admit was kind of my case because I had had the experience. I just didn't believe that the experience I'd had was what he was talking about. And that may be your issue as well. But in the earlier stages of sadhana, we don't necessarily have the certainty when we're trying to meditate on the self of what we're doing. So there's a twofold challenge in this samyama. We often don't have an experiential feel for what purusha is. And second, because purusha is so mixed up with buddhi, and this is really the heart of the issue, we often believe we're in contact with purusha when in fact we're experiencing the sattvic state of purified buddhi. This, by the way, this is why it's really helpful and important to study what the texts say about these different inner instruments, to really try and understand what buddhi is, what ahamkara is, what manas is, and, you know, and feel into it and contemplate it. One of the things that this kind of contemplation does is it helps us realize how important it is to purify the buddhi. Because the more you study what the yogic masters say about practice, and the more you experience your own meditation, the more you realize that the purified buddhi is a prerequisite for knowing the self. So the purified buddhi is highly sattvic. It's quite joyous and free. And one reason is, you know, when we feel into the clarity of buddhi, it's so much more free and loving than our regular clogged up mind that we may believe that we're in touch with the self, which is, because in general, humans on the spiritual path tend to confuse sattvic states of purity and happiness with the self itself. And this is not to say that sattvic states are not wonderful. I love them myself. But it's also important to recognize that there's more beyond that sattvic state, because sattva guna, remember, is still inside prakriti. So it's still inside the world of limitation. And the more we can, but nonetheless, the more we can sense into the felt sense of buddhi, to feel what it's like to experience your buddhi, the more it's possible to disentangle her from ahamkara, from the egoic mind, which has its own power and importance, but which tends to classify all experience as me or not me, whereas buddhi is capable of standing outside its personality self and really experiencing reality as it is. So a purified buddhi really is our best friend in sadhana, whether it's facing inward towards the self or bringing the fruits of its inward focus back into daily life. Because as you know, and those of you who go deep into meditation, or even a little bit into meditation, you know, when you experience the clarity of a meditative state, you bring that clarity back into your life. That changes the way you experience the world, because, you know, buddhi is actually the screen upon which all experience is seen and felt. It's sometimes compared to a movie screen or to a mirror. So your experience of the room you're in, the device you're hearing me through, this voice, you know, that I'm speaking in, it's all being projected or reflected onto buddhi. And here, now here we get to the gist of it. When buddhi can accurately reflect the inner and outer reality that's being projected, it's also able to make clear discernments about what's beneficial and what isn't, what's right for you and what is not right for you. It can see through a conspiracy theory. It can tell the difference between a lie and the truth. It has a feel for that. It knows in the moment what that is the right decision without having to endlessly cogitate about it. You know, obviously, this is why some people with clarified buddhis, tend to be more free and wise than people whose buddhis are all clogged up. And this is, of course, why spiritual practice is so great. It's because before it does anything else, it will start to clarify your innate intelligence. So neuroscientists, you know, talk about the executive function. The executive function is an aspect of buddhi. So is willpower. the will to do sadhana, to create a sankalpa and follow it, is an aspect of buddhi. And the sage Abhinavagupta, who's a tantrika, not a Patanjali yogi, but I would say Patanjali would probably agree, Abhinavagupta says that discernment, Sanskrit word for it is tarka, T-A-R-K-A, discernment is the highest of all practices in yoga and the only one that leads directly to liberation. You know, the other practices we do are enormously significant and important and indeed necessary. But the thing that puts you over the top, the quality within you that allows you to actually fully experience the truth, is your ability to discern it through the purified buddhi. This is Abhinavagupta again, and I think this is such an important statement. I'm going to say it a couple of times, and I'm going to suggest that you hold on to it. He says the most important kind of discernment is discerning between what is to be held close and what is to be discarded. The most important discernment is discerning between what is to be held close and what is to be discarded. What you say yes to and what you say no to. You know, what is important and what is not. Steve Jobs once said something very similar. He said, if you want to do something powerful in life, you have to know when to say no. You know, you can't say yes to everything. You have to discriminate. You have to discern. And in Vedanta, that type of discernment called Viveka in Vedanta is the instrument you use to discover what is absolutely real, what is unchanging and eternal from what is merely passing. And in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that the highest gift of grace is what he calls buddhi yoga, the yoga that we practice through the discerning buddhi, the inner discrimination that lets you discover the sacred in the midst of what seems mundane. And by the way, Krishna associates buddhi yoga with devotion. In other words, he says that to those who love me, I give buddhi yoga, by which they're able to, he says, come to me, by which they're able to merge in God, to merge in the absolute. So it's the most incredibly important practice to do what we must do to purify buddhi. Of course, the problem is that, you know, obviously when the buddhi is dusty, covered by the schmutz of your ideas and your samskaras, that discernment is not fully trustworthy. This is the reason that pure awareness comes to identify with what it's seeing reflected in the buddhi. It's because the buddhi is distorted. And, you know, I don't have to tell you this. If it's the body that you're identified with, then you absolutely believe that the state of your body is the state of your soul. So you genuinely believe I'm fat or I'm sick, when actually your body may be overweight or your body may be sick, but you are not sick because you are consciousness. And this is not bullshit. It's not something that people say to make you feel better about your problems. It's the truth. So, you know, if you say I'm depressed, what that really means is that there are negative thoughts and emotions in the mind. It doesn't mean that you are depressed because you are consciousness. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't do whatever you have to do to be healthy in the body and healthy in the mind. But it's also true that it's a lot easier to do, you know, to work on yourself in day-to-day life if you also understand that you are carrying the power of pure consciousness, which actually can miraculously transform every part of your life. One of the characteristics of meditators who've trained ourselves to meditate on awareness itself, or who have been given the experience of awareness free from thoughts by a teacher, is that when you're poised in the experience of witnessing, you're actually free of reactivity. so you can move through the world without getting derailed by what other people say to you, by your addictions or by the pleasure and pain that's inevitably a part of life. So, and I know that there's, you know, there are many levels of this. There are a lot of people who think that they're fully immersed in consciousness and are actually just doing a form of spiritual bypassing. But nonetheless, we need to get there. Now, it's also true, and this is really important, that the primal tendency to confuse, for Purusha to get confused with buddhi, which leads to egoic identification with our individuality and our body and et cetera, actually is purposeful. When Purusha is focusing outward through buddhi, it receives and experiences all the diversions of worldly of earthly life. And according to the sages of Tantra, as well as certain commentators on the Yoga Sutra, this is why we're here, to experience and learn. You know, in Tantra, it's said that the primordial divine consciousness, which is completely transcendent and totally whole, fragments itself into individual consciousnesses for the sake of experiencing otherness, and then creates a world in order to experience that. So this is one of the purposes of the entanglement between Purusha and Buddhi. But there's another purpose, and that is because when the two are entangled, eventually Buddhi begins to turn inward, usually because it's realized over the course of lifetimes that most worldly experience is entirely unsatisfying, or at least partially unsatisfying, and, you know, has gone through enough suffering to, you know, desperately hope for a solution that will allow it to be happy, and to eventually realize that it's the samskaras, the kleshas, which make everything so confused. So as buddhi turns inward through meditation and self-analysis, it can begin to notice the difference between reality and our ideas about it, to see through the tendency of ahamkara to identify with experience, and the tendency of manas to distract itself. And it then can begin to reflect buddhi. And that's when the beginning of truly ingoing sadhana occurs. Again, what we've been talking about here in the first three classes is that as buddhi becomes more and more clear, we haven't actually said it exactly like that until today, but this is the truth. As buddhi becomes more and more clear, and as you learn to recognize its clarity as your resting place, you are in a position not only to allow Purusha to self-realize, you also have access to the extraordinary powers that are part of the creativity of Prakriti, because buddhi is the subtlest part of Prakriti, and the clarified buddhi has access to the entire creative panoply of Prakriti's power. So the basis of the siddhis is first detachment from body, mind, and samskaras. Once you have detached yourself from body, mind, and samskaras, and gotten the purity of buddhi, then you can clearly see the witness consciousness as separate from the mind. Consciousness can start to expand, and we naturally become capable of extraordinary things. So we're going to practice the samyama that Sutra 35 is referring to. The caveat here is that in doing this practice, you may not be fully accessing Purusha. You may be. You know, but the possibility is there. And you will certainly be tuning deeply in to buddhi, to the awakened aspect of buddhi. So remember, the practice here is for discerning the distinction between buddhi and ahamkara. Between buddhi and Purusha, and also between Purusha and ahamkara, is to meditate on that which exists only for itself, which And we're going to do it as a classical inquiry process, inquiry into the nature of our awareness. Many of you have done this with me before or some version of it. It's also the main practice that most of the teachers of contemporary non-duality or Neo-Vedanta, like Rupert Spira and Adyashanti, use as their primary practice. The version of it that we're going to be doing is not, it's definitely not original, but it came to me intuitively, as it may have done for many of you. So back in the day when my guru would talk about the self, as I said earlier, I used to get really confused. My guru's basic teaching was meditate on the self because God dwells within you as you. I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know how to know that I was meditating on the Atman. I actually, in those days, I used to meditate on the rising feeling of bliss and Shakti. And I would ask myself, is this the self? I've come to believe that it is, actually. Inner experience of Shakti is very much a way of meditating on the self, but it's not direct like this practice. So one day, my guru said in a lecture, quoting Shankaracharya, the great Vedantic sage, he said, the Atman, the inner self, is the witness of the mind. And when I heard that, for some reason, you know how sometimes you hear a teaching and it just goes boing and you have an aha. I realized that was the answer to this question that I've been asking. And I went back to my room and I began to do an inquiry. And the inquiry that I was doing was asking myself, where is the witness? And focusing backwards to try and discern what it was that was watching my mind. So we're going to do this in just a minute. But what I noticed as I did it, and if you've done this process and as we do it together, you'll probably have this experience yourself, is that what I came across was layers. I found a watcher, but when I focused on it, it turned out there was a witness behind that. So I focused on that witness, and sure enough, there was another witness behind it. And every time I would center myself in the witness, I would become aware that there was something behind the mind watching that. And then at one point I popped, so to speak, into a space of pure knowingness where awareness just opened up. And what I realized is that the inquiry had somehow primed the pump so that the witness could kind of pop out. So, and this is how, you know, again, as many of you know, this is how the spiritual process of Atmavichara or self-inquiry works. You use the mind, you use the Buddha, you use the intelligence, and it's kind of like you focus your mind on the question, on the inquiry, and hold space, hold an open space for the true experience of the witness to emerge. Sit, you know, find your posture, sit quietly. Focus on the sit bones. It's really helpful as you do this to be in an alert posture, to be, you know, really awake. And we'll take a couple of minutes to ground ourselves with the breath. Inhale upward from the perineum as we were doing earlier, allowing the breath to sweep upward, focusing, allowing it to move through the pelvis, the navel, the heart, the throat, but not stopping to notice where you are. And then inhale from the crown down to the area of the perineum. See if you can feel the subtle currents of the prana moving through your inner body. Inhaling upward from the perineum to the crown. Exhaling downward from the crown to the perineum. And with the next inhalation, allow your attention to rest in the area just underneath the crown. We're going to access this space, this space just at the top of the Ajna Chakra, just below the Sahasrar, that we entered last week when we did that meditation on the space, the light in Brahmarandra. And if you remember, you in doing this practice, which we used last week to ask, to invoke the presence of great beings, of siddhas, this is also a practice for invoking the presence of the pure Atman. So imagine that you're in touch with the space about 8 fingers above the crown and about 2 inches to the back. And just bring your attention there, slightly above and behind the head. This is going to be the station from which we begin this inquiry. I'm choosing this because I found that it's particularly conducive to get a sense of your own awareness as a felt experience. Partly because it is slightly out of the physical body, though it is not outside the subtle body. So when you're in this space, you're not in your physical body, but you are in your subtle body, which is also a part of your personal space. So breathe now with this sense that the inhalation draws your attention upward to this space above and behind the crown. And exhale, letting your breath radiate and with your attention here, there may be a slight feeling of energy and pressure. But with your attention here, ask the question, where is the witness? Or may I be shown the witness? You're not looking for a location. You're not looking for a verbal answer, and this is really important. The question is there to just prompt the ever-existent self to poke its head out and let you experience what you are. Where is the witness? Or may I be shown the witness? In many ways to ask this question. And over time we find the way that is most psychoactive for us. At a certain point as you ask this question, you start to get a sense that there is indeed a presence, an intelligence, a knowingness that is present behind your personal experience of the body, the questions, the meditative arising. So as you get a sense that there is indeed a watcher, a knower present, focus your attention on that. And as you do, you may also become aware that something is witnessing that witness. So focus backwards again. Focus again on the witness. Let's call it the new witness, the second witness. see if you can keep allowing your awareness to segue backwards, or perhaps for some of you it may segue upward, to a deeper and deeper sense of that part of your awareness that's present to the question. If there comes a point that you're just guided to be present with whatever is arising, do that. That's great. But if thoughts or body sensations or doubts come up, again, ask inwardly, what is witnessing this? Show me the knower of these thoughts and feelings. Where is the witness? What is the witness? Show me the witness. So for many of you, thoughts will be coming up, questions will be coming up. Memories of previous practices will be coming up. Commentary might be coming up. Just keep asking yourself, what knows that this is happening? What is aware? What is the witness? Notice if you're tensing or straining in this inquiry, and relax, soften. Whenever you become aware that there is a presence or an awareness that's behind or deeper than the awareness that you've contacted, focus on that. recognize that you are being led through your own inquiry deeper and deeper into the field of your consciousness, deeper and deeper into the clarity of buddhi. Where is the witness? At a certain point, you won't need words for the question. You'll just direct your attention towards the knowing part of your citta, your buddhi. Can you station yourself in that space where you're aware of the watcher, of the knower? Can you let yourself be the knower? Don't worry about it, just notice. The knower is subtler than the sensations in your body. It's subtler than the thoughts. It's subtler than your sense of yourself, your normal sense of self. And as you give full attention to that sense of witness, you may notice that it's not just behind you, as it were, it also is present on all sides and above and below. Where are you now? Now it's very possible, indeed probable, that as you experience this clarity of presence, as you intuit and experience this witnessing presence, you're probably experiencing the reflection of Purusha in the mirror of the buddhi. The buddhi turns inward, and that innate discriminative faculty of buddhi is what is able to focus on the part of itself that is seeing, that is watching, that is witnessing. So as you keep bringing attention back to this awareness and stationing yourself there, there probably has been for some of you, a real shift, so that you're stationed in a deeper part of yourself. But even if there hasn't been, this practice is deepening the clarity of buddhi. It's clearing the rajasic and tamasic elements from buddhi. And as you practice this, and I want to ask you to do this practice, we're going to do it some this week, I want to ask you to do it creatively. So find the prompt, the question, that actually engages buddhi. It's not just routine. And have what's sometimes called faith. Have faith, have the expectation that even if it hasn't happened already, that at some point the Purusha will self-reveal, which is what she has to do. Purusha is generally considered to be masculine, so what he has to do, what it has to do. So the great paradox of meditation practice, as you know, is that we do this samyama, we do this inquiry, because it powerfully opens us to the experience of pure consciousness. Yet the focus itself won't create the experience. Purusha has to show herself, show himself. But what I'm hoping, and what is my experience in this practice, is that there's something very revelatory and transformative of seeing the self reflected in the buddhi, of recognizing that this is an aspect of your consciousness that, even though the witness keeps moving backwards, it puts you in touch with a part of your consciousness which is, the word that comes to my mind is solid, it's unchanging. When it reveals itself, it's both familiar and also has a way of just putting everything else in your life in perspective. So when you actually have this revelation of Purusha, or the experience of the buddhi reflecting the clarity of the self, it really feels like a wake-up. You know, like you got an intimation that pure consciousness is real, what you really are is awareness. You wake up to what's behind your thoughts and feelings. And it's true that it might slip away as soon as I start talking, or as soon as buddhi gets colored by thoughts and perceptions. But it's really not that unusual in the contemporary spiritual world. And the reason it's not that unusual is because the reflection of the Atman in the purified buddhi is a natural experience. It actually should be normal for all of us. When you do this kind of inquiry over time, you are going to experience this kind of awakening. It's absolutely real. It's not full self-realization, as you know. It's not full liberation. It's a stage on the path. It's a glimpse. And what I have noticed is that many people who teach direct path focus, direct path experience, are people who have this experience partially, and God bless them for it, but who are not necessarily fully self-realized or fully liberated. So they will have received many of the gifts of the purified buddhi and many glimpses of the reflected purusha, but they're still identifying with experience and with the instruments of experience. And what this means is that many people, and I include myself, are, you know, who teach this, who can even transmit the experience, are only partially awake. And it's very important, this is one of the reasons why it's so important to understand what the sages say, so that you don't get caught in thinking you're done when, you know, you've actually just begun to recognize what's possible. Someone I know who's a very brilliant teacher, who became one of the leading non-dual teachers of the 90s and early aughts, had this capacity to stay poised in the knower, certainly while he was teaching, and he fully believed that he was enlightened. So in this state, he would receive intuitions about what his students needed. He would see the students' egos popping up, you know, in that obnoxious way that egos sometimes do. And he would get an intuition that what they needed to do to bust the ego was, you know, to immerse themselves in freezing water for half an hour or some other, you know, really austere practice. And he had complete confidence in what he suggested they do. And there was a certain point where many of the students began to push back because they began to feel that what he was asking them to do for to dissolve the ego was actually abusive. And as I think many of you know, what really dissolves the ego is not austerity, but love. And eventually his community asked him to step down. And what happened when this, you know, when he was asked to give up his role as a teacher was that he was plunged into a dark state where all the unprocessed shadow feelings he'd been ignoring came up and he had to process them. Now, this is a good argument for doing your psychological work while you're meditating and doing inquiry, but it's also a very deep teaching about how easy it is for the buddhi to be colored by unhappy psychological states, as well as, you know, qualities like pride and stubbornness and all those other very human qualities. It's really important when you have extraordinary experiences in this realm to remain very willing to question yourself, because what happens as you begin to access the witness, that is when the buddhi has become sattvic enough to reflect pure consciousness, as Sutra 36 tells us, it also gives us access to pratibha, the profound intuitive wisdom, which we've talked about earlier, which is one of the most miraculous qualities of the human being. Pratibha, you know, is that wisdom which can bring alive the subtlest areas, kinds of intuitive wisdom. And when the buddhi has become truly sattvic, you also get access to the subtle senses, the experience of inner visions, inner sounds, intuitive visionary experience that shows you things at a distance, but that can sometimes turn your meditations into psychedelic light shows. So Sutra 36 says, Tata pratibha shravana vedan darshasvada varta jayante. From this purified buddhi and immersion in purusha when it reveals itself, pratibha, intuition, as well as higher hearing, touch, vision, taste, and smell are born. By intuition, says the commentator Vyasa, comes knowledge of, quote, the subtle, the separated, the remote, the past, and the future, things normally inaccessible to conventional means of knowledge. So it becomes quite easy and quite alluring to see through the the ordinary forms of existence. And experiences like this are, I actually think, quite significant. In some traditions, notably Zen, we're told to ignore them. My guru had them a lot, and he shared them unreservedly, and he regarded them as significant precisely because they give us the understanding not only that we're, you know, that our meditation is kind of cooking, but also it shows us a lot about the inner world. It gives us a lot of understanding about the extraordinary capacities that live inside us, which is, you know, tremendously helpful. So this practice of meditating on, you know, doing inquiry into what is the witness, what is the self, and allowing Purusha to self-reflect inside buddhi, it's the source of some of the most significant siddhis. Now, that said, Sutra 36 is immediately followed by Sutra 37, which we've spoken of before, which says that these powers, intuition and subtle sensory awakening, I love the way he says this, they're accomplishments for the outgoing mind, meaning that they help the mind to turn inside, but they become obstacles to samadhi because they're so interesting that they can distract you. And again, every tradition will tell you this. You know, all the great teachers want to keep meditators from getting too entangled in siddhis, but there's a really good reason why Patanjali talks about them so much, because they are very definitely signs of progress on the spiritual path, especially when you're able to work with them intelligently. One of the things that is not generally discussed in the yoga tradition, though it's very much a part of the tantric traditions, is that these subtle intuitions and visions and sounds can actually be used as meditative objects, as focal points in our deepening meditation practice. So the deeper states of samadhi, you know, vichara samadhi, ananda samadhi, the immersion in blissfulness, asmita samadhi, which is kind of where we were pointing with this meditation, that is contemplation of the pure I, which is the witness. They're doorways into inner states, and they're really incredibly important advanced practices. So that said, to rephrase the warning of Sutra 37, don't deny or denigrate the experiences. Just don't stop with them. Just keep going. Just keep penetrating deeper into the inner world. That statement that was painted on Ken Kesey's bus, further, that's it. That's the way to hold your experiences. I have a friend who used to have the most dramatically visual meditations of anyone I know. He may still have them for all I know. I just haven't seen him in a long time. He would close his eyes and a light show would start. And eventually, he began longing for quiet. So he began to do an inquiry in meditation. As he sat with the lights and sounds, he would ask a similar inquiry to what we were doing. He would ask, where is the self in all this? Where is the self in all this? It's a great inquiry. And as he did, he trained his buddhi to look through the visions and lights and focus on the awareness, the consciousness that held and contained them all. And he began to experience all this as being like a movie. And to be able to focus behind the visual state, the visionary states, and enter the witness states behind it. So this kind of meditation where there's a lot of activity going on in your meditation, as you practice with it without getting so engaged, you know, so in love with it, is that the focus on these subtle experiences let the citta soften and release into the field of prakriti, which is really the field of shakti. Whereas the meditations that focus on the witnessing presence will lead you through the so-called adjunctive instruments purify buddhi so that it can reflect purusha, and also give you the ability to act with discernment when focused outward. So both methods are very, very valid. They both take you to subtler and subtler layers of being. And again, as we've been saying, the more you soften into the underlying energy of the mind, whether through focusing on the prana, focusing on an inner experience, focusing on the witness, the more that energy dissolves the samskaras. So let's just take a couple of minutes to do a contemplative meditation. So firm your posture. This is a new practice. It's actually a practice that Pandit Rajmani teaches. He calls it Vishoka meditation. Vishoka means sorrowless or joyful. So this is a meditation that opens you to the subtle body. Begin by focusing on the breath. This is a practice which involves the very subtle prana. And bring your attention to the crown. Exhale and allow your attention to descend through the forehead. And you can do this actually on the outside of the head. And you'll understand why in a few minutes. So you're in the crown. You descend to the forehead. And then you descend to the center between the eyebrows, which is just a little bit below it. And then you descend to the nostrils. You're exhaling, and then you let the exhalation flow out through the nostrils into the space in front of your face. It might be six to 9 inches in front of your nostrils. And then inhale, feeling that the inhalation comes in from this space in front of your face, flows into the nostrils. Let yourself feel the breath flowing in through the nostrils. Feel the breath rising, touching the area at the corners of your eyes, touching the area between your eyebrows, touching the forehead. And let the breath and your attention descend from the forehead to the space between the eyebrows, to the corners of your eyes, to the nasal passages and the nostrils, out the nostrils, to the space in front of your head, in front of your body. And inhale, the breath flows into the nostrils, up, touching the inner corners of the eyes, flowing up to the center between the eyebrows, flowing up to the forehead. Just let yourself follow this breath pathway. The focus is on the front body. You're experiencing the forehead, the space between the eyebrows, the corners of the eyes, the nostrils. On the exhale, the breath is flowing out the nostrils and merging in the space in front of the body. And then the inhalation flows in from that space through the nostrils, rises upward, touching the nasal passages, corners of the eyes, space between the eyebrows, the center of the forehead. And the exhalation flows downward from the center of the forehead to the space between the eyebrows, to the corners of the eyes, flows through the nostrils to the space in front of the nostrils, 6 to 9 inches in front of the body, which is within your subtle body. Let the breath find this pathway, flowing very subtly from the space in front of your face through the nostrils, flowing up the nasal passages, touching the corners of the eyes, the space between the eyebrows, center of the forehead. You don't have to stop doing this meditative practice just because the gong has gone off. And I would ask you to really linger there, and you might also take a couple of moments, a couple of minutes to write down what you experienced, to journal about it. And I'm going to ask you to do this practice as one of your meditations and explore it more deeply. What's particularly interesting about it, I feel, is that it actually connects the physical body with the subtle body, and it will, as you do this over time, and maybe it has already, it will begin to expand your sense of your personal space. Essentially, it'll expand your consciousness. And the pranic opening that occurs when you practice this over and over again, it it helps you really experience the subtlety of the prana. The prana as a current, which is in itself awakening. We're focusing a lot in these meditative parts of this class on upper chakra meditations. And I wanted to speak for a minute or two about Sutra 38, which is also a practice that we discover through meditating in the upper chakras. The Sutra 38 says, by loosening the cause of bondage and by knowledge of the passageways of the mind can enter into the bodies of others. This is like a really jazzy city. And it's not that uncommon. If you read the accounts of yogic lore, you'll know that the ancient yogis did it and modern yogis do it. So, and some of you here have written to me that you actually have found yourself doing it. I've had some experience with it also. This experience of entering another person's body or feeling very intimately attuned to another person's body is not that unfamiliar with people that you're extremely intimate with, a lover or a close friend whom you have a lot of trust for, sometimes even a child. And it's actually not a practice that I recommend doing deliberately because it can be quite invasive. But there are times when it will happen. I used to actually do this with a friend. We knew each other quite well. We worked together. He had a lot of psychic powers. And we would sometimes be sitting in the same room and we would find our consciousness sort of flowing back and forth between our bodies. Someone that I met during that period used to refer to this, you know, he regarded this as a tantric practice. It's a way of, you know, kind of merging your consciousness with another person. And as I say, it's easy to misuse. So it's something to be very careful of, but it's a real thing. And it's a practice that can be quite helpful for healing and intuitive understanding in appropriate circumstances. You know, if you've read a lot of the Puranas and the hagiography of Buddhism and Taoism and Tibetan Buddhism, you'll know that there are a lot of examples of practitioners who can do this. Yogananda writes about it in Autobiography of a Yogi, describing the experience of his master entering the body of a disciple to help him, to actually save him from a disease, to allow him to act with power he didn't have on his own. And this siddhi is also described very minutely in Book 3 of the Shiva Sutras. So the thing that's interesting about this particular sutra is it actually is giving the protocol for using this ability. And clearly, the yogi has to have cultivated a very strong samadhi such that he can enter samadhi at will and has practiced it enough so that his karmic structures have dissolved, so that the kleshas are dissolved. And that's a high bar. The point is that the mind is naturally all-pervading. Your mind, when freed of the kleshas, can become large enough to fill the entire world. But because of the kleshas and your karmic samskaras, it's trapped in your body for the duration of this lifetime. So these karmas are loosened through samadhi, and the more you understand the karmic patterns, the more you're able to detach yourself from them and realize that they're superimpositions. You free the mind to help travel out of the body. In addition to having loosened the karmic backpack, a yogi also needs to understand how the pranic channels, the nadis, work. The nadis, the energy channels that carry prana around the body, also carry the mind, which is how in meditation we are actually able to focus the mind in the pelvis or in the crown or in the heart and have the experience of these centers quite powerfully in many cases, because the mind travels through the nadis. So the nadi that's described in the commentaries on this sutra is called the chittavaha, or mind-carrying nadi, which carries energy upward and serves as a pathway that you could follow that leads you out of the body at death. It's an offshoot of the sushumna, but it's apparently somewhat distinct from the sushumna, the central channel, although all the channels, all the nadis that operate in the highest, in the Ajna and Sahasrara chakras are very, very close to one another. So, and they're connected, this practice is connected with the Udana Prana, which is the part of the vital force, as many of you know, that moves upward in the body and that also carries Kundalini. When Kundalini is moving upward, it travels on the Udana Prana and it travels in the central channel in the Sushumna. So if a yogi is practiced with this pathway, if a yogi knows how to move between these nadis, it becomes no big deal to enter, to leave your body and literally settle into another's. So just as the subtle body leaves the physical body at death, and we can learn how to do this through the central channel, such a yogi can transfer his subtle body to a new body, but also have the ability to return to it, to his own body. There's a scholar in the Jain tradition which actually gives written instructions in this process, and he says that after leaving your body through the crown, you should enter the other body by joining with the apana prana, the downward flowing breath in that body. Then, these are his words, you should spread oneself from the navel chakra to the heart in this new body through the sushumna nadi. Use your own breath to obstruct the movement of the prana until the new body falls flat. And at that point, the yogi can move within this body for a few hours and then to return to his own body, hopefully after reanimating the one he has borrowed. So the instructions don't tell us what happens to the body that's been occupied in this way, but what I've been told by people who are adept in this kind of practice is that, and also this is what the mythology says, that the body the yogi enters is a body on the verge of death. So what the yogi does is animate a dying body for a few hours. And the most famous story about this is from the hagiography of Shankaracharya, the great exponent of Vedanta. This story is actually in the How to Know God translation of the Yoga Sutras, and it's one of my favorite stories of all time. And he was in a debate with a rival scholar named Mandana Mishra. And the rule in those days was that if you were in a debate with another teacher and you lost the debate, you had to become the disciple of the winner. So in this case, Shankaracharya was a monk. Mandana Mishra was married to a woman who named Bharati, who was acting as the referee in the debate and who was considered to be an incarnation of the goddess Saraswati. So at one point, she started asking Shankara questions about sexual technique. And Shankara, having been a renunciant from his childhood, couldn't answer the question, so he asked permission for time out and entered the body of a dying king and then reanimated it and enjoyed lovemaking with the king's queens and concubines and also began ruling the kingdom in such an enlightened way that his subjects were blown away. And finally, of course, this always happens in these stories, he forgot because he became identified with the king's body. His disciples had to come and sing him a song, one of his own songs, which said, "Remember who you are, O beloved. Remember who you really are." And he came to and got back into his body just at the last possible moment and returned to the debate and won it, of course. So there are many stories like this in the Puranas and in Tibetan yogic lore and even in Zen, obviously don't try this at home. There are obvious ethical reasons, but also because it's a little dangerous if you're not adept at it. There's another sutra, which I want to go into a little bit more next week because it makes a lot of great claims, which says, the state of mind projected outside the body, which is not an imagined state, is called the great out-of-body experience. And through it, the destruction of the covering of the light of buddhi occurs. Again, you probably know people, maybe you've experienced it yourself, who in meditation actually leave the body and travel. There was a lot of research on this in the mid-20th century by a teacher named Robert Monroe, who wrote a book called Journeys Out of the Body that he actually taught people how to do it. And one of my friends who did this process and later had it happen spontaneously in his meditation said that the channel for moving out of the body for this kind of journeying was very similar to the channel we worked with last week, the one that's located above and slightly behind the head. My friend experienced it as arising from the upper cervical spine. Apparently, there's a direct channel to it that comes up from the brainstem. So, and my intuition is that when shamanic practitioners do spirit journey, traveling out of the body, they actually use this passage. Again, this is something you don't want to try at home, because it's really important if you're going to do out-of-body journeying to, you know, essentially have a babysitter, somebody who's going to sit with your body and call you back. But what everyone who does this has shared is that there is actually a cord, a thread made of light, which connects your subtle body, which is the body you journey in, back to your own physical body. So actually, it's pretty impossible, I'm told, to permanently leave the body this way, because the cord will bring you back. But I want to do a final meditation focusing on the brainstem and just feeling that channel. And what I'm going to ask you to do is breathe vertically up the channel. That channel is usually quite clogged. And what that means is that it's actually harder to receive higher intuitions. But if the channel is kept open through prana, through breathing in meditation, then it becomes possible for wisdom from the higher worlds to actually travel towards you, travel through this channel. Put your fingers at the top of the hinge where the head moves backwards. There's that little notch underneath the occiput. Just find it and then move your attention backward into the head and contact the brainstem, which is just behind that area, and which it also connects to the cervical spine. As you know, the cervical spine doesn't end at the neck. It actually ends at the brainstem, so it's about an inch inside the skull. See if you can hold your attention there in the brainstem. And inhale and exhale from that place into that place. I've found that meditating on the brainstem, breathing in and out of the brainstem, is a very relaxing process, because the brainstem is where we hold a lot of our tension. And you can begin to release and soften and relax your brainstem through this process, which will relax your whole body as you keep doing it. With the next inhalation, feel that the breath moves upward from the brainstem inside the head up to that place we were meditating in earlier, the place above the crown and just behind it. So inhale through, with the feeling that you're inhaling through the channel, that you're letting your breath very softly open the channel. So you inhale up to that place 2 inches behind the head and slightly above it, and then you exhale downward back to the brainstem. So you're simply allowing the breath to clear these channels in the back of your head. The breaths should be very soft, and there should be no agenda. It's really like you're exploring and opening a part of your subtle being. And when you really are able to do this, starting from the brainstem and inhaling upwards to this secret place above and behind the head, you're clearing a lot of karmas, a lot of impurities, a lot of schmutz, very softly. Inhale from the brainstem up to the space above and behind the crown. And exhale downward. I want to offer you this practice as a way of beginning to release tension in the brainstem and in the area of the head beyond it. You might find that as you begin the practice, you become aware of tension in your neck. As you keep doing this soft form of breathing, it will actually release your neck. It will begin to align your head with your spine. And on a subtle level, it begins to remove confusion, lack of confidence, as well as the feeling of not being connected to your higher self. It's quite a powerful yogic meditation. So allowing the breath to flow in this channel, ask, where does the breath and my buddhi want to take rest within this body? Maybe it's in the heart. Maybe it's in this area that extends through from the brainstem up to the soft palate and opens up into the ajna. Recognize that every part of your body is filled with secret places that have extraordinary secret powers, that there's so many capacities hidden within your body. And allow yourself to realize the extraordinary good fortune of being in this human body at this amazing time when so much knowledge is available to us. Thank you so much for practicing. I send you so much love and thanks. Namaste.